On the night of February 18th, 1965, 500 or so people gathered at the Zion United Methodist Church in Marion, Alabama. They had planned to walk the half a block to the city jail, where they were going to protest the arrest of James Orange, a field secretary for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC, by singing freedom songs outside the jail. Doesn't look too different from what we have done here in Madison recently. But on their way, they were met by a wall of city police officers, sheriff's deputies, and Alabama state troopers. The streetlights were turned off, and the law enforcement officers and other white men began to chase and beat the protesters. Around 10 troopers chased a group of protesters into Mac's Cafe, which was directly behind the church, and started hitting people inside. They clubbed 82-year-old Cager Lee to the floor, and when his daughter Viola Jackson tried to defend him, they clubbed her too. When her son Jimmy tried to help her by putting himself between her and the police officers, a state trooper shot him in the stomach. Troopers then followed him outside and beat him until he collapsed. While he lay in the Good Samaritan Hospital in Selma, fighting a growing infection from the wound, he was served with an arrest warrant by the head of the Alabama State Troopers, and the troopers were cleared of charges of dereliction in their actions that night. Jimmy Lee Jackson died on February 26th. Jimmy was one of the shining stars of Marion. He was the youngest deacon in his Baptist church, a former U.S. soldier, and an employee at the county hospital. He was well thought of and respected in his town, and his death both outraged the people of Marion and became a catalyst for the civil rights movement. A 2005 article in the Alabama newspaper, The Anniston Star, said that the injustices perpetrated on blacks in the 1960s Alabama were countless, but when this happened, when an unarmed black man was shot down by one of George Wallace's officials sworn to protect the people, movement leaders, as well as the rank and file, and the blacks of Marion were outraged. The SCLC had arrived in town in January, the month before, and Jimmy had tried to register to vote several times before that. Martin Luther King Jr. wired the president's attorney general the night Jimmy was shot, saying, "This situation can only encourage chaos and savagery in the name of law enforcement unless dealt with immediately." The SCLC were already in Selma as well, organizing for voting rights for blacks. And so they channeled the outrage and started the plans for the Selma to Montgomery march. After the first attempt to march, which was met by brutal police resistance and dubbed a Bloody Sunday, Dr. King called on clergy to join the march with words that expressed the same idea of white woundedness and responsibility in systemic racism that we heard in our readings. The telegram he sent to the clergy read, "In the vicious maltreatment of the defenseless citizens of Selma, where old women and young children were gassed and clubbed at random, we have witnessed an eruption of the disease of racism with cheeks to destroy all of America. No American is without responsibility. All are involved in the sorrow that rises from Selma to contaminate every crevice of our national life. The people of Selma will struggle on for the soul of the nation, but it is fitting that all America help bear the burden. I call, therefore, on clergy of all faiths, representative of every part of the country, to join me for a minister's march to Montgomery on Tuesday morning, March 9th. In this way, all America will testify to the fact that the struggle in Selma is for the survival of the democracy everywhere in our land." Mark Morrison Reed reports in his book, The Selma Awakening, that about 250 Unitarian Universalist ministers answered this call. Reverend Morrison Reed also reports that this response represented a shift in how UUs saw the struggle from something they acknowledged to something they shared. There were exceptions to this generalization, as some UU ministers already shared the struggle in how they lived, and Reverend James Reeb was one of those. Jim, as he was known by his friends, had come to Unitarianism while preparing for the Presbyterian ministry, after growing up a devout and conservative Christian. He was called to serve the All Souls congregation in Washington, D.C., in a racially mixed neighborhood, where he organized programs and projects to help the poor. He left All Souls in 1964 to accept a position with the American Friends Service Committee, and he and his family moved to Dorchester, Massachusetts, and started working to better living conditions in largely black and economically depressed neighborhoods of Boston. He came to understand that the suffering he witnessed resulted from fundamental inequalities in society and the government's treatment of people according to the color of their skin, what we now call systemic racism. He was a member of the Unitarian Arlington Street Church in Boston, and he often preached as a guest minister in nearby suburban congregations. He used those preaching opportunities to urge people in largely white congregations and communities to pay attention to and to work to change racial injustice. He spoke against the racial disparities enforced by laws in the South and by economic and social segregation in the North. Duncan Howlett tells this story of how Jim reacted to hearing about Dr. King's telegram. He wanted to go. He wanted to go very much. This he knew with total clarity. He felt an almost irresistible impulse to call Marie, his wife, put on his coat, and head for the airport at once. He knew there were risks. He had seen with his own eyes how the Alabama authorities proposed to deal with freedom marchers, and the next time the injuries might be more serious. But these reflections did not lessen the impulse, which had seized Jim like an external force. They increased it. All the blows should not fall upon the heads and backs of the Negroes, he thought. They had already suffered enough. It was time now for privileged white people who believed in integration to stand with them and take some of the blows too. And so he called the area representative of the SCLC, who affirmed his desire. And when he went home and talked to Marie about it, she protested, of course, telling him he belonged in Boston. And he replied, "No, I belong there. It's the kind of fight I believe in. I want to be part of it." So Jim was on a plane that night. He arrived in Selma on the morning of March 9th and participated in the second attempt at a march, the one that Dr. King stopped when he suspected a trap by the law enforcement officials on the other side of the bridge who looked ready to let them pass unharmed. The UU ministers gathered together when they returned from the Edmund Pettus Bridge with the rest of the very confused marchers that didn't understand why they weren't going forward. And they discussed whether to stay or whether to leave at that point. Jim decided to stay. He was attacked that evening. He and two other UU ministers, Orloff Miller and Clark Olson, were walking to Brown Chapel for a meeting where Dr. King was going to speak. They had just eaten dinner at Walker's Cafe, an integrated restaurant that they intentionally chose. Tensions in Selma, such an understatement, tensions in Selma were high. White allies were scoffed at and taunted, and the minister's restaurant choice marked them as allies and therefore a target. Jim was severely injured by a blow to the head, and he died 2 days later. A 2005 article in the newspaper, the Alabama newspaper, the Anniston Star, says that Jimmy and his family knew, and the rest of the protesters in Marion knew, that a night march was the most dangerous thing they could do, and yet they felt they had no choice but to protest in this way. their minds were stayed on freedom. And Jim Reeb believed that all the blows should not fall on the heads and the backs of the Negroes. And so he went. His mind, too, was stayed on freedom. Dr. King eulogized both Jimmie Lee Jackson and Jim Reeb with words that resonate with this morning's readings from James Baldwin and Wendell Berry, both written around the same time. At Jimmie's funeral, he said, "Like every self-respecting Negro, Jimmie Jackson wanted to be free. We must be concerned not merely about who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderer." And at Jim's, he said, "So in his death, James Reeb says something to each of us, black and white alike, says that we must substitute courage for caution, says to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murder. His death says to us that we must work passionately, unrelentingly, to make the American dream a reality, so he did not die in vain." There were differences in responses to these deaths, too. There was outrage when Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, but it was mostly limited to his town and within the freedom movement. The national outcry started when the events of Bloody Sunday were televised and people were given the images of the brutality against black people. But somehow, shocking as this footage was, it wasn't enough to move most people into action. It was the death of a white minister at the hands of rabid white racists that moved the nation. And so as I reflect on more recent outrages, the killings of black men and boys at the hands of law enforcement officials, and violence against black women and trans people, I move to wonder how deeply these things are affecting those white people who don't yet know they're wounded. Who don't yet know they're wounded by the systemic racism that allows and even encourages this continuing outrage. What is it? What is it that keeps people blinded? How is it possible, 50 years after Jimmie and Jim's deaths, that black people and white people still internalize our parts in racial oppression? That we still believe we deserve our fates? I wonder what it will take to wake us up fully. And still, in the midst of that wondering, I do believe that awakening has started. I believe we are beginning to hear, we are beginning to have conversations within and across racial lines about what it still means to be living in this system of institutional racism. I've witnessed the beginnings of change. Here in Madison, I see white people alongside young, gifted black leaders chanting Black Lives Matter and All Powers to the People. I see new ways of organizing. I see new definitions of leadership. I see new understandings of the system. I see willingness in people who have their whole lives and their whole histories been the people to say, this is how it is, learning to listen to people who see things differently. Within the Unitarian Universalist Association, I see intentional anti-racism work happening, slowly, but happening. Allies for Racial Equity, for example, which I serve as a steering committee member, hosts an annual anti-racism conference for white allies. But this year's conference will be a joint conference with the People of Color organization to which ARE is accountable, the Diverse Revolutionary UU Multicultural Ministries, or DRUM. All workshops this year will be co-led by people of color and people who are white, and who will focus on work we can do together in environmental justice in New Orleans. And just the emergence of that environmental justice movement, a movement focused on the intersections of racial and economic and environmental equity, marks a sea change in how people in the dominant culture see how systems work to continue to keep marginalized people in that place. And within the wider world, there are grassroots movements cropping up everywhere, in every piece of these intersections, in issues of race, in issues of economics, in issues of environmental justice. They're cropping up everywhere, and they're aimed at educating and organizing people around these intersecting injustices. So it's happening. It's starting to happen. And if we are brave, if we can shake off those internalized oppressions and dominations, if we can move outside those circles drawn around us, we can see it. And if we can draw on the power of love when we do see it, if we can move with that which arises within and between us, we can move the rest of us. Oh, my friends, do you hear? Do you hear?